Hello, Radio Maria listeners. Welcome back to the Quest for a Culture of Life in America. Whether you're listening on air or on your computer, we're glad to have you back after a week off for the Mariathon. I hope you all contributed to that and have helped Radio Maria to continue this good work. Our guest today is going to be Stephen Mosier. He's president of the Population Research Institute, which is an international organization dispelling the myth of overpopulation and many other things. Steve is an internationally recognized authority on China and population issues, as well as an acclaimed author and speaker. He has testified before Congress and many state legislatures and travels all over the world helping people understand how the world is so becoming depopulated. Steve is the first American social scientist to visit mainland China. He's invited there by the Chinese government. But as a result of his visit, he exposed their one-child policy, their forced abortion policies, and so forth. So he was no longer welcome after that, and probably cost him his degree from Stanford. So, Steve, are you there on the line with us today?
I am, yes. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yes, well, sir, we're so grateful for having you, and we're looking forward to your visiting us here in Dayton next week. You're going to be making two presentations available to the public here. And I've got Debbie Nieport with me here this morning from 40 Days for Life and Elizabeth's New Life Center to tell our listeners about those two presentations that you're going to be making. So why don't we go ahead and say the Hail Mary to help us get started, and then I'll let Debbie tell the listeners about your presentations here in Dayton, and then we'll be asking you lots of questions about your work at PRI and about yourself. So in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. So, Steve, before we ask Debbie to tell us about these two presentations you're going to be making here, would you tell our listeners a little about yourself? Where did you grow up, and your parents, your siblings, your religious background? What role did religion play in your growing up, that kind of stuff?
Well, I was born in a little lumber town in Northern California 62 years ago. I grew up in the Central Valley of California, mostly on my grandfather's cotton farm, which was a healthy way to spend your summers. My parents were non-practicing Christians. My father was a non-practicing Catholic, my mother a non-practicing Protestant, so we never went to church. I was pretty much secularized by my experience by my education at the University of Washington and later at Stanford, and probably would have considered myself when I went to China in 1979 to be a secular humanist. But being in the operating room when a woman who was 8 months pregnant was forcibly aborted changed my mind on a lot of issues. It changed my mind on the issue of life, because when you're present at a third trimester abortion, there's no doubt, Steve, as to what's going on, because you can see the results before your very eyes. They did a cesarean section abortion on this poor woman who didn't want to be there, who was ordered to be there, and the result was a dead baby and a wounded mother, a mother wounded not just in body by the operation, but in spirit as well, because she'd had a baby conceived in love with her husband in an intact family, a wanted child, literally ripped from her womb and executed. And so I became pro-life at that moment, and I have been pro-life ever since. I also, at the same time, saw a great evil, you know, the taking of an innocent child's life is, to me, probably the greatest evil that man can commit. And I was drawn to the good after that. I was repelled by that evil. I was repulsed by that evil. And I sought the good. And if you seek the good, of course, you will find God. And ultimately, he led me to the Christian faith. I became Catholic on a beautiful Easter morning in 1991, finding my way back to Rome, sweet home. And I have the good news to report that my mother, some years later, followed me into the Catholic Church.
Oh, beautiful.
Mm. So we're still praying for my father, who's 88 years old. But one by one, they're coming in. My wife and I have, rejected the one-child policy that China has imposed upon its own people. And my wife and I have 9 children.
Wow, congratulations.
Ranging in age from 28 down to 11.
Okay, very good. So you're contributing to the overpopulation myth, or contributing to the overpopulation, if there is such a thing.
We're actually contributing to the solution of the depopulation problem that we have around the world, and also helping to maintain Social Security. I mean, my 2 older children are now in the workforce and making their Social Security payments, which, of course, goes in one door of the Treasury and one day, and then out the next morning as Social Security checks to the retired.
Yes, yes. I know how it works. I've got 15 children myself. They're not all working, but some of them are. So we're doing our part. We're doing our share. You're going to be coming to Dayton. I don't want to miss an opportunity to promote your presence here in Dayton. We're so happy to have you come here. You're going to bring your wife, Vera, with you, I believe. So we're going to be doubly blessed. Debbie Neaport, can you tell our listeners what's happening next week?
Absolutely. First of all, Steve, it's such a tremendous pleasure to be here and to just at least hear you on the radio. I'm very much looking forward to you being here and speaking to us in person. I've known about you for a while and about the overpopulation myth. I've actually bought into that as a college student. And when I came into pro-life work and realized the myth of that, trying to share that truth with whoever will listen to me. But when the opportunity came to bring you here, Bonnie Burrell Donahue, who is part of the Sinclair Traditional Values Club, thought how we could be able to provide opportunity for people to see you. We went hard to work, and we have 2 great opportunities to hear Dr. Stephen Mosher while he's in Dayton on Wednesday, October 19th. The first time is at 3:30 p.m. at the Sinclair Community Center. That's at building number 8 in the basement at the stage area. And then again that same evening on Wednesday, October 19th at 7 p.m. at St. Albert the Great Church. And that's at 3033 Far Hills Avenue in Kettering. And we were able to bring you here through the great support of the Council 500 Knights of Columbus, as well as the Dayton Right to Life and the local 40 Days for Life leadership team, Radio Maria, One More Soul, and the Traditional Values Club at Sinclair Community College. So we encourage everyone out there to set this time aside. This is a unique opportunity to hear from the world expert on this subject, and it's simply something that you don't want to miss.
Thank you, Debbie, and maybe we can have to announce those times and places again toward the end of the program.
Absolutely.
Steve, tell us about your educational experience. I know you said you were was it Washington State and then Stanford, and what happened with your educational program?
Well, I went to Stanford University. I was in the anthropology department. I was actually teaching at the University of California at Berkeley when I was selected by the U.S. government to be in the first wave of Americans scholars to go to China in 1979. We normalized relations with China on January 15th of 1979. I was in China by March, and spent the next year in-country. The Chinese government was actually not very happy about the idea of allowing me to, an inquisitive social scientist, to wander about the countryside asking questions to people, because I can read, write, and speak Chinese. They tried to provide me with 2 interpreters. I said, no, I don't need interpreters. Of course, they were really minders. They were really members of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs who were supposed to follow me around and make sure that nobody said anything to me that was critical of the Chinese Communist Party. It took me a couple of weeks to get rid of them, but get rid of them I did. And after that, all doors were open to me. So when the one-child policy actually began, I was living in a village. I saw women arrested for the crime of being pregnant. These women were carrying babies conceived in love 6 months, 8 months before, when it had been legal to have second, third, and fourth children. And now all of a sudden they were told their pregnancies were illegal. I went with them as they were taken to the lockup, and of course, as I've already told you, I went with them as they went to the abortion center to have the lives of their unborn children snuffed out. I was invited, into China by the Chinese government once they agreed to let me come, and I was after my research, I was invited to leave the country. The Chinese government, Beijing, was very unhappy about my reports criticizing the one-child policy, and declared me to be a spy. So I know that I have a very thick file at the Ministry of State Security in Beijing. It's hard for me to get back into China. I did go back last year. From time to time, they let me back in, and then I go and testify before Congress about human rights violations in this or that area, and I'm barred from China again for 2 or 3 years.
It's amazing that they let you in.
That's well, it's touch and go. You know, they did let me in last year. I went to visit a number of Catholic villages in China and ordinary villages. And the difference was this: in the ordinary villages, you would see very few children, and almost all the children you would see would be little boys. You know, there's a terrible problem in China with female infanticide, the killing of baby girls at birth. And also with sex selective abortion, the killing of baby girls before birth by parents who are only going to be allowed one child and are determined that their only child be a son. So there are 100 million girls in China who've been killed over the last 30 years by these two means, not by the government.
Did you say there are Catholic villages? Did you say Catholic village?
There are Catholic villages in China. Remember the Jesuits, the Dominicans, were in China 300, 400 years ago during the last decades of the Ming Dynasty. Father Matteo Ricci, for example, was there and built the North Cathedral in Beijing on land that was given him by the emperor. But the entire villages were converted to Catholicism. And if you visit those villages, there are lots of children. And the children are both boys and girls. In fact, the head of one village had 7 children when I visited, and his oldest daughter was just about to take her final vows into a local order of religious approved by the local bishop. And I said to him, how does it happen that you here have gotten away with having so many children? And he said, when the population control police come, we hide our pregnant women. And because it's a village that's 100% Catholic, they can get away with that. They control the village. It's a separate, you know, it's a separate little community. And you can see the cars of the officials coming down the road from a distance. And so the women go into hiding.
Well, I thought that you have reported in the past about families being severely penalized if they actually have a child that is not licensed, not permitted by the government. So does that still happen in these villages? It seems like they'll all lose their homes and their livelihoods.
Well, that does happen throughout China. These Catholic villages, however, have a few Catholic villages because they're 100% Catholic. The people there have been able to protect one another, mostly from the depredations of officialdom. You know, you go into an ordinary village and you see slogans painted on the walls saying one child is best and have only quality children and for the country. And these Catholic villages, you go in and you see slogans painted on the walls, but they're not one child policy slogans. They're slogans like do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Beautiful.
So they did manage to hide. They do manage to hide their children when the official census takers come by, and in that way avoid the fines. When the fines are imposed, they gather together their funds and pay them collectively. So they value children, and they've been able to have many more than the one child allowed them by law.
You've written about your experiences in China and your experiences with the Chinese people. Can you tell our listeners about some of your writings, your books?
Well, I've written a number of books about China. The book that I probably like the most of all the ones I've written is called A Mother's Ordeal. I like that one because this is a true story. It's a biography of a woman who in China was a population control worker. And she was in the business of doing what I've just described. She was in the business of arresting women for the crime of being pregnant, of taking them to a government holding pen, a holding tank, of subjecting them to days and days and days of propaganda sessions intended to break their will to resist and to coerce them into having an abortion. And she was the one who actually took them in while the doctors were doing the operation and killing their unborn children. And then she herself became pregnant with a second child. And she realized that the horror of what she'd been doing. She realized that she very desperately wanted to keep this child. And so she applied to her superiors for permission to have a second child, and they laughed at her and said, you're a population control worker. You know what the rules are. We can't possibly allow you to have a second child. Well, her husband was in the United States. She managed to join him, and we were able to, she contacted me, and we were able to get her political asylum, allowing her to stay in this country. And when I did that, Steve, I didn't know that she had been a population control worker in China. It was only later, as I got to know her better, that I realized what her past had been and how she had gone from being victimizer of other women to herself being a potential victim. But the story has a happy ending because the family of the husband, the wife, and their now two children did at the end of the day convert to Catholicism and are now all members of the church. So that's a great story, and it's a story that, although it was published a few years ago, could have been written yesterday because there are still many, many, many cases like this. There are still forced abortions in China, still forced sterilization going on. The Chinese Communist Party shows no intention, has no plans to abandon the policy anytime soon.
So did this family go back to China, or did they stay in the United States?
Oh, they received political asylum and live now in the United States.
Now, how did you get involved in this ministry or apostolate?
Well, you know, the Population Research Institute was founded by a great Benedictine monk by the name of Father Paul Marx, who had a PhD in sociology and was very interested in the life issues. He was galvanized into action back in 1968 when Humanae Vitae was issued, and many of his brother monks didn't understand it and refused to abide by it. So he set off to Washington, D.C. He founded organizations in Washington, Human Life International, later Population Research Institute, went on to found pro-life organizations around the globe. And I worked with him from the early 80s on. I mean, he was probably the first pro-lifer that I ever had any contact with. I remember it must have been back in 1983. I was in exile from Stanford University. They were investigating my research in China, and they ultimately denied me a PhD because they didn't like what I had to say about forced abortion in China or population control, for that matter. So I was in exile, and Father Marx called me and invited me to speak at one of his conferences. Well, I wasn't at all sure I wanted to go because I had been taught at Stanford to keep my distance from people of pro-life sentiments, you know, these radicals. But I went because no one else was listening on the left, and I found myself in the midst of the most warm and loving and kind people I had ever met, who were engaged in a struggle from which they could receive no possible personal gain, at least not in this world. And over time, I began to want to be like them. So Father Marx brought me into the pro-life movement. He introduced me to many good pro-lifers. I became a regular speaker at his conferences, and then in 1995, he invited me to come and be the first president of the Population Research Institute. I gladly accepted. My wife and I, by then, had been praying get involved in a pro-life work full-time, and we took this as an answer to prayer. So I immediately accepted his job offer. And then he said to me, can you work for free? And I said, no, Father. I said, I have five children, and my wife is pregnant with my sixth, and I can't. But, well, we came to an accommodation. I took a pay cut and came out and worked with him. He was a great man. He passed away last March 20th. But until the end of his life, he served as the chairman of our board of directors at PRI, and I would talk to him every few days and update him on our work around the world. And I know that he's helping us from his new and more exalted state in heaven to continue this work that he began.
He's in a more powerful place for helping all of us.
Absolutely. He's standing before the throne of God pleading for the lives of children.
So tell us what the Population Research Institute does. You know, I know you do a lot of things.
Well, we have programs around the world. Let me start with the birth of 7 billion person, which the United Nations Population Fund tells us will happen on October 31st. Now, there are two views of the birth of baby 7 billion. There is my view, which is that the birth of any baby, including baby 7 billion, is cause for celebration, because it's new life coming into the world. Represents another victory over death. It represents, for the first time, we'll have 7 billion people on the planet. We have never lived longer, healthier, wealthier lives than we live at the present time. So I think this is something we should celebrate. Now, there are a lot of people that disagree with me. In fact, I'll be debating some of them later this week. Groups that think that the planet is overpopulated, groups that think like Population Matters in the UK, which are advocating a two-child policy for the United Kingdom, Great Britain, groups that applaud China's one-child policy, like Carl Pope of the Sierra Club, groups that think that we need to reduce the population of the world and achieve what they call sustainability. I'm a conservationist. I grew up on a farm. I run a farm in the Shenandoah Valley now. I raise Angus beef cattle, pigs, chickens, and children. and we take good care of the land. But these people have fallen into a kind of earth worship. They worship creation rather than the creator, and they think of human beings as a kind of pestilence on the planet. So they have a very different, gloomy, a grim, a dismal view of baby 7 billion. And, you know, I think it's no accident that the United Nations Population Fund, which is an anti-people group that has supported China's forced abortion, forced sterilization policy for 30 years with lots and lots of financial aid, it's no accident that they picked October 31st for the birthday of baby 7 billion. Because what is October 31st? It's Halloween. I think they're trying to scare us.
Yes, I there's no question about that. They're trying to scare us. They're ignoring a lot of sociological and demographic data that I think you would claim shows that a growing population is beneficial from the economy standpoint, from sociological standpoints. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the first thing that I say to them is look, just look at the numbers. Sure, we're going to pass 7 billion this year, and then the population growth, which is slowing, is going to continue for a couple of decades. We're going to peak at around 8 billion, and then the population of the world is going to decline. So if you're worried about human numbers, you don't have to force us all to limit ourselves to one child. You don't have to posit that man is the enemy of the environment. You just have to take a deep breath and wait, because before the end of this century, we will be back to 7 billion again on the way down, and the population of the world will be shrinking.
That won't be good. That won't be good. That'll be a disaster. I mean, because we're going to have a continually aging population and fewer young people to take care of us old people.
Absolutely, and you can see in Europe's present our collective future, because the reason why Greece and Portugal and even Italy and Spain are having trouble now paying their way is because they have aging populations and so few young people coming into the workforce that they cannot support the growing numbers of elderly who rightly insist that the promises made to them in terms of retirement benefits and health benefits be kept by a government which is receiving less and less money from tax revenues from a shrinking pool of young people. So ultimately, this is Europe is entering a demographic recession. It's entering a recession like Japan's that is caused by a rapidly aging population. These are countries, Steve, which have failed to prepare for the future, failed to provide for the future in the most fundamental way by providing the future generation. And if you don't provide for the future by providing the future generation by having children, you lose everything.
Now
you lose your country, you lose your people, and ultimately, you go into the dustbin of history.
You on your website, you have some very good educational resources. You have some videos that are kind of neat, and you talk about the replacement rate. The average woman needs to have 2.1 children in her lifetime to replace, just to keep the population stable. Can you explain that a little bit, 2.1? I know that you're saying that you need two to replace herself and a male, but where does the 0.1 come from?
Well, in every human population, there are a few more boys born than girls. And usually that ratio is about 106 little girls, 107 little girls for every, I'm sorry, for 106, 107 little boys for every 100 little girls, because it turns out that we actually are the weaker sex. And more of us die, more little boys die in infancy and childhood than little girls. In part because little boys take risks that little girls don't, and so you need to have 2.1. You need to have a few more little boys at the beginning in order for there to be enough partners for people of both sexes. So we say in demography, we say we need 2.1 children rather than 2.0, because 2.0 would mean a few little girls could not get married. There wouldn't be enough boys to go around. So, but you know, that's an average, and it's kind of a deceptive average, because you don't need everyone to average exactly two children to maintain the current population. There will be people who don't marry for whatever reason. Some of them we call priests and religious, and that's a wonderful calling. Some people on the left refuse to marry, refuse to take upon themselves the responsibility of marriage and childbearing. And what we need to understand is, and what I said in Russia when I went to Russia for a demographic summit with Russian leaders a couple of months ago, was this: you need to make Russia into a family and child-friendly country, not with the idea of requiring everyone to have children, but with the idea of enabling couples who are willing to be generous in having children, like the Coobs and like the Mosiers, to be able to act on their beliefs. You see, in the United States, there's a lot of frustrated fertility. If you ask young women how many children they'd like to have over their lifetime, they average about 2.5. So there are a lot of young women who can't get married because they can't find a willing partner. There are a lot of women who get married and find themselves infertile. So we need to have laws and policies that enable those of us who are willing to be generous in having children and provide for the future, act on those beliefs. And if you have a third of the population willing to have 3, 4, and 5 children, they can replace the children that go missing because of those individuals who don't marry or won't have children.
Now, was the Russian government receptive to your ideas? And what specifically did you recommend to them?
Well, first of all, in Russia, the average Russian woman has 7 abortions over her lifetime. Mm-hmm. Abortion is almost a way of life in the former Soviet republics. It became a way of life in the 1920s when the Bolsheviks equated sex with having a drink of water and tried to undermine marriage and thought about raising children in state-run facilities. They invented the abortion machine that is still used today. Such an abortion machine was invented in the Soviet Union back in the 1920s. So they've relied on abortion for decades. We urge the Russian government to put restrictions on abortion, to make abortion illegal. And they have begun to make some moves in that direction. The Russian Duma has passed a new law requiring a waiting period before an abortion of 24 hours, and also requiring that advertisements for abortion mention that this is a dangerous procedure and always results in the death of a child. Those are steps in the right direction. Obviously, they have a long way to go. We also urge them to set up crisis pregnancy centers across the country, and that appears to be underway now, with crisis pregnancy centers opening in cities from St. Petersburg to Vladivostok, under the direction of a young, very dynamic Russian pro-lifer by the name of Alexei Komov. And there are other things they can do. Now, Russia does have the largest baby bonus in the world. Russia pays every couple in Russia which has a baby a one-time bonus of $13,500. Now, that's the largest baby bonus in the world, and it has caused a little blip in the birth rate. But, of course, it takes more than a one-time payment to encourage people to be generous in having children. It takes a culture which is open to life. It takes continued help to raise a child from birth to adulthood. And so what I urged the Russian government to do was take anti-people propaganda out of your economics, out of your ecology, out of your biology textbooks. Make sure that children in Russian schools understand the importance of marriage and family and make them open to life. I also urge them to protect young Russian couples from taxes. Don't just give them a one-time bonus. Young couples who are willing to have two and three and four children are a precious resource, and they shouldn't be paying any taxes. They're raising future taxpayers, mm-hmm. and they should be allowed to do that without any exactions from the state.
Now, has the Orthodox Church in Russia been a supporter of
Absolutely. We had Patriarch Kirill, mm-hmm. who is the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, issue several statements in advance of the demographic summit. He was one of the backers of the demographic summit from the beginning, and of course remains a strong voice for traditional morality in Russia today. So I'm delighted with that. Some of my books on this issue, on the population question, are going to be published soon in Russian. I don't want to see the Russian people disappear from the earth. I don't want to see the Russian people extinguish themselves. But they need to be open to life.
And so are you saying that the Russian government appears to be open to your suggestions?
Well, 5 years ago, Vladimir Putin declared that Russia was in the midst of a grave demographic crisis, mm-hmm. and instituted this baby bonus that I spoke of. Just this year, in response in part to urging from experts who convened for the demographic summit, restrictions were placed on abortion. The baby bonus was actually increased. So Russia's moving in the right direction. We will be back in Russia next year for another meeting with senior officials and encourage them to take more steps. Russia's right now losing almost 750,000 people each year from its population. Mm. Population is aging rapidly. It is 144 million people now. Unless they increase their birth rate, they will lose tens of millions of people in the years to come. Someone will come to occupy Russia in the future. If the Russians don't start having children, those people who occupy Russia will not be Russian. They may be Chinese. They may be members of another nationality, but they won't be Russian.
So is the Russian going to hire you as a consultant?
I work for free, Steve.
I think Debbie's got a question for you.
Well, actually, I had a comment. I had the opportunity to go to Moscow a few years ago to participate in a conference for pregnancy centers that was in part hosted by Heartbeat International, and it was done through the Orthodox Church. And what I felt was that it is a cultural problem. There's not an adversarial situation between the what we would call the abortionist and the pro-lifers in Russia. It's actually a very, almost in a way, a collaborative. We learned that in the hospitals, the state-run hospitals, the abortion clinic could be on the third floor and the pregnancy center on the second floor, and there was the center, the pro-life center, would never send them to the abortion doctor, but the abortion doctor would freely send them down to the pregnancy center. But so it's not an adversarial type relationship like it is here in the United States, but it is a cultural thing. It's a changing the mindset of the Russian people to be an open to life. And so I think it's exciting that you're in there talking about the population component. Pregnancy centers are there trying to provide the means by which people can see that they can bring new life into the world. And one question I did have for you, Steve, is that I've received some emails that seem to show that the Chinese government is open to allowing people to have more than one child because they see what's happening. But is this by license only? And what have you heard about that?
Well, there are a couple of ways to exempt yourself from the one-child policy. One way is if you live in a village, and if your first child is a little girl, the rules now allow you to have a second child. And the reason for that change in the rules is simple. The government is, in effect, saying, do not put firstborn baby girls to death. Allow your little daughter to live, and we will give you another opportunity to have a son. So that's the one big exception. The other exception is this, that if you and your wife are both only children, the government will give you permission to have not one, but two children. And the final exception is if you're wealthy, if you run a factory that exports goods to the United States or Europe and you have a lot of money, you can pay a fine, a huge fine to be sure, but pay a fine, and the government will allow you to continue your pregnancy. Now, those avenues are available to some people, but they do not represent the abandonment of the government's position that it has the right to dictate to you and to every person in China how many children you can have or can't have. The government decided a long time ago in China that it would control reproduction in the same way that it was controlling the production of steel or bicycles under a state plan. And that state plan still exists. And I worry, you know, the radical feminists say their worst nightmare is a situation, a social situation, where women are kept barefoot and pregnant. Well, one day soon, as China's population begins to decline, as China experiences a nationwide labor shortage, which is slated to begin next year, the Chinese government will realize that they need more people, more babies, not fewer. And in the same way that they've ordered young women to come in for abortions, I believe they would not quail at the idea of ordering young women to conceive and bear children, even when they may not want to. I mean, after all, the state has control of reproduction in that country.
And the 2.1 replacement rate is not valid anymore because the number of women of childbearing age is going to be less than the number of men. So to replace, they're going to need to have three children or four children or whatever.
Well, that's true. And, you know, one of the reasons I think that the Chinese government in years past has never been as vigorous as they could be in stopping female infanticide, in stopping, in enforcing the law against sex-selective abortion, is precisely because it serves their greater plan of limiting the population. If you can eliminate girls from the population, then it doesn't matter how many excess men you have running around. The birth rate is going to plummet because obviously only women can bear children.
So is there a shortage of women to marry these days in China?
Oh, absolutely. There are tens of millions of young men in China who cannot find brides because their brides were killed years ago, decades ago, by sex-selective abortion and female infanticide. And that shortage of women has given rise to all kinds of social problems. We now see in China the kidnapping of young women in remote rural areas, and they're brought to more prosperous coastal regions and sold as brides. We see cross-border traffic in women where young girls are purchased in North Korea and brought across the border, or where young women in Vietnam and Burma are told there are factory jobs in China. And when they're taken across the border illegally, there are no factory jobs. There may be a job in a brothel, but there are no factory jobs waiting. So, you know, you might think that as women become scarce, because so many little girls have been killed, that their status would increase, that they would be treated with more respect and dignity. But the opposite seems to be happening in China. They're treated with less respect and dignity. They're treated more and more like a commodity to be bought and sold, the scarcer they become.
So is the Chinese government still hell-bent on acquiring Taiwan? And
well,
would that be a source of what's the population situation in Taiwan? Do they have a same?
Well, Taiwan is in similar straits as China because Taiwan, along with South Korea, was one of the first test grounds for population control programs back in the mid-1960s. Both South Korea and Taiwan were dependent upon the United States for their defense against aggression from China, from North Korea. And so when we launched population control programs, we went to the Taiwan government and the South Korean government. We said, you need to lower your birth rate in order to develop economically. And we funded population control programs in both countries. And right now, both countries, for a long time, have had too few babies to maintain the current population. Both South Korea and Taiwan are now desperate to increase the birth rate and have abandoned their two-child policies that were really forced upon them by our country, the United States of America. So we haven't done these countries any favors. And right now, when you look at the Philippines, which is the only country in that part of the world which still has a robust birth rate, you know, the Filipinos average still about three children. We are putting tremendous pressure through our foreign aid program on the Catholic Philippines. And we're joined in that by the World Bank, by the International Monetary Fund, by the European Union. And all of those agencies are saying to the Philippine government, you need to drive down your birth rate. There is actually a bill before the Philippine Congress now to impose a two-child policy on that country and to punish couples by withdrawing government benefits if they have a third child. Now, I think the world needs more Catholic Filipinos, not fewer. And I'm absolutely opposed to these short-sighted population control programs because look at what they did to Taiwan and South Korea. Those countries are now facing labor shortages, are now facing rapid aging because of them decades ago. Don't we learn from our mistakes? I mean, are we going to allow history to repeat itself again?
Well, we continue to fund these depopulation programs throughout the world, Africa and South America and all over, I assume. Is that the case through the UN and through our own aid programs?
Well, we do. Beginning when the Obama administration came into office, first thing that they did was double funding for population control programs overseas. And, of course, before the last election, they had an absolute majority in the House and Senate. So the money spent on population control programs went from $500 million to $1 billion. And so we began to export whole container loads of drugs and devices, condoms, IUDs, Depo-Provera, to relatively innocent, untouched corners of the world. So, you know, these programs don't reflect the reality of falling birth rates and dying countries around the world.
What is the perceived benefit to our United States of America for depopulating these countries?
Well, the argument, of course, of the left is that in order to protect the environment in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, we need fewer people. We need to drive down the birth rate. Then you have the pure population controllers who think that the world would be a better place with, say, not 7 billion people, but 3 billion people or 2 billion people. And then, of course, these programs are supported by radical feminists who believe that abortion is a human right and who really have no love for marriage and no interest in childbearing and seek to export their views, their worldview, their lifestyle to women in more traditional parts of the world. So those are the big supporters of the programs on the left, the radical feminists, the radical environmentalists, and the radical population controllers. And unfortunately, they're the ones in power in Washington right now. I mean, President Obama's science advisor, John P. Holdren, is a longtime colleague of Paul Ehrlich, the population bomb guy. And Holdren believes that there are too many people on the planet and that we would collectively be better off if we cut our numbers in half. And the reality is, if we cut our numbers in half, we would be poorer and much less well off than we are today.
Years ago, we were told that there wouldn't be enough food on the planet to feed people. Has that argument gone away, or is it still being touted?
Well, it's still being talked about, but the fact is, you know, in the 1960s, that argument first began to be made. In fact, it was made most famously by Dr. Paul Ehrlich, my former colleague at Stanford University. In the opening sentence of his book, The Population Bomb, he wrote, "The battle to feed humanity is over. Hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in the 1970s. Well, hundreds of millions of people didn't starve to death in the 1970s because what we had in the 1970s was the Green Revolution, which increased crop yields in places like India and in Latin America and other Asian countries. And India went, for example, from being an importer of grain in the 60s to being an exporter of grain in the 1970s because of the Green Revolution. So he got it wrong. And, you know, we now know that with current agricultural technology, you know, without gene splicing, without any technological advances, with current agricultural technology, we could raise enough food on the planet to feed 12 billion people. We'll never get to 12 billion people. We're at 7 billion now. We're going to peak at 8 billion. Then our numbers are going to decline. So there is not a global shortage of food. There are local shortages of food, and there always have been, and I suppose there always will be. But they're generally caused by inept governments that interfere in the production of food, or they're caused by civil wars or civil unrest where food is used as a weapon to starve civilian populations into submission. So you still get man-made famines, but there's no global shortage of food.
I'm going to ask Debbie to again tell our audience about your presentations here in Dayton.
Well, I don't know about anybody else, but this has been absolutely enlightening to me and just an absolutely wonderful experience to listen to Dr. Mosher. And so I encourage anyone who can set aside Wednesday, October 19th, two opportunities to hear Dr. Mosher here in Dayton, 3:30 p.m. at Sinclair Community College, Building 8 in the basement area, stage area, and then again at 7 p.m. at St. Albert the Great Church at 3033 Far Hills Avenue, that's on Route 48 in Kettering. We're absolutely delighted that we've been able to bring Dr. Mosher here with the help of the Greater Dayton Chapter Knights of Columbus, Dayton Right to Life, 40 Days for Life, Radio Maria, One More Soul, and the Traditional Values Club of Sinclair. And I am going to be there, and I hope to see many others.
Thank you, Debbie. Steve, what are you doing to help the government realize their mistake and try to defund these depopulation programs?
Well, we do a number of things. We have offices in Latin America and Europe now, and we have affiliates in a couple dozen countries around the world, places like the Philippines. In I've always been particularly concerned about Latin America because Latin America consists of Catholic countries, which have written in their constitutions the sanctity of life. Most Latin American constitutions have provisions that say life begins at conception, and from conception, life is deserving of protection. So we're trying to defend Latin America from intrusive population control and abortion policies. We investigate abuses on the ground. We report them back to Washington. We've been able to get some funding cuts over the years to these programs, and I think we'll have more funding cuts in the future.
Are you able to do any testimony in Congress?
Well, this year, for example, I testified in March about China, and then I testified in May before what we call the Helsinki Commission, the Organization of Economic Security and Cooperation, which involves mostly European countries, but also has Japan and Korea as affiliates. And I talked about the demographic decline of many of our allies, which means that in the event of conflict, they would not be able to raise armies. They would not have the economic wherewithal to help us in the event of conflict. So, the demographic decline of places like Japan and South Korea also has security implications.
I have seen conflicting data on the birth rates for Muslim families. Can you speak to that?
Well, the Muslim world is a very mixed picture. So, there is conflicting data, depending on what part of the Muslim world you look at. Countries like Turkey, Tunisia, have birth rates, Jordan, have birth rates that are below replacement. The Turks, the Tunisians are having too few children to maintain the current population. Then there are places like Afghanistan, where in those remote mountain valleys, marriage is still universal in mid-teen years, and women are averaging 6, 7, 8 children. So the Muslim world is a very mixed picture. But the largest Muslim country in terms of population, Indonesia, is now falling below replacement. So over time, I think the Muslim world will come to resemble the developed world in terms of its falling fertility. This is a universal phenomenon. It's occurring everywhere. It's occurring in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The only countries that don't seem to be following along are a couple countries in Africa where, because of waterborne disease, infant and child mortality rates are going back up. And you know what? The biggest determinant of fertility rates is how many children the parents want to have. And that won't surprise you. It didn't surprise me. But it surprises the population controllers because they believe that in order to reduce the population growth, you have to force the birth rate down. You have to drag the women into those clinics to give them their Depo-Provera shots to insert those IEDs and to tie their tubes, when in fact the best way to bring down population growth is to ensure that children survive infancy and childhood. Because when parents see that their children are surviving infancy and childhood, many parents will have fewer children because their goal is to have 2 or 3 children survive to adulthood. And if they have to have 6 children in order to have 2 or 3 survive to adulthood, they'll have 6 children, knowing that half of them will die in infancy and childhood. But if they know that most of their children are going to survive, they'll have fewer children. So we should really follow the better angels of our nature. We should be helping to provide primary health care to lower infant and child mortality rates around the world. Even if we're worried about population growth, I'm not. But I tell the population controllers, if you're worried about population growth, help reduce disease in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and the birth rate will come down naturally without your coercive policies.
Steve, you're going to have to let it go for today. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great program. We're really looking forward to your presence here in Dayton next week, both you and Vera, and we will treat you well here. So God bless you, and thank you for being on the quest for a culture of life in America.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm looking forward to my visit to Dayton.
Okay, God bless you. Let's close with the memorare. Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, that never was it known that anyone who fled to your protection, implored your help, or sought your intercession was left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, we fly unto thee, O Virgin of Virgins, our Mother. To thee we come, before thee we stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother, the Word incarnate, despise not our petitions, but in your mercy graciously hear and answer us. Amen. Thank you, Radio Maria listeners. Tune in again next week. God bless you.